is always a pleasure and an honor to speak to people, men and women of vision, and I do mean vision in the larger sense in this particular case, the cosmic sense, the universal sense of things. Paul LaViolette has distinguished himself for many years. He's a PhD, he is a scientist, he is a great thinker, but more than that, he is truly a visionary in terms of what the universe seems to present to us. His book, Earth Under Fire, has been considered a classic for a number of years now. We're going to talk to Paul about that and other things as well. So let's say hello again to Paul LaViolette, PhD.
Hello, Jeff.
How are you, Paul?
Oh, pretty good.
Let's see. We were talking today, and you've been on the program at least twice.
Hmm.
And the first time, I think, was in 1939. Seems like it.
Long time ago.
It was at least 10 years ago. And then the last one was, I think, three or four. But Earth Under Fire. Let me read, if I can, from Paul's website to all of you just for a minute. If you're not online, it is etheric.com. How'd you get that? That's a great handle for a website. Etheric.com.
I got my name in early, I guess.
I'll tell you.
Somebody tried to buy it from me, but I wouldn't sell.
I'll bet they tried. Yeah, gee, that's a good one. At the closing of the last ice age, our ancient ancestors endured one of the most lethal global catastrophes to have occurred in the course of human history. Intelligent minds of those times thought it imperative to construct a message that would endure through time and be understood by the descendants of those who survived. Employing sophisticated cryptographic puzzle techniques, similar to those modern astronomers, use in designing extraterrestrial communications, they created a time capsule message that described the elusive celestial cause. It's interesting. The elusive celestial cause of this tragic disaster, alerting us that it could reoccur at long intervals and arrive at Earth's doorstep virtually without warning. So something caused the ice age that was off-planet. We all know the story about the mammoths with greens literally still in their mouths. They were quick frozen. Other amazing data remains, too, to point to something very drastic, very radical, and extremely quick. This ancient cipher is today displayed in the heavens in the form of the 12 zodiac constellations, Greek, Egyptian, Babylonian versions. Its informational content having been passed from, way back in the beginning, all the way down orally in the lore of astrology. Also, certain esoteric keys were handed down to help unlock its message, the Sphinx being one and the Tarot being the other. This is not science fiction. Let's find out from Paul why it isn't science fiction. All right, Mr. LaViolette. The astrology signs that we know and love are not the same necessarily that you're talking about here. They're variations.
Right. I use the lore of astrology, looking at the signs metaphorically, what they're saying. This is work I did when I was going for my PhD at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the system science program, and I was working on a physics theory that used systems concepts.
What does that mean, systems concepts?
Looking, for example, at a biological organism like human being as a system.
Mm-hmm.
We are open systems. That's one term that's used, meaning that we have to keep eating to stay alive.
Gotcha.
The typical trend in the universe is towards disorder. It's the principle of entropy, second law of thermodynamics. And the question arose, why is it the life seems to violate that, where order increases rather than decreases?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that, it's because we our open systems, we take in energy to counteract the decay, the entropy that's going on all the time.
Right.
And so this is an example. These concepts can be applied to many different kinds of systems. And I was studying general system theory.
Okay.
And I began to realize that these principles, which we, Western science, had discovered just in the last 100 years, well, less than that, Ludwig von Berlanz, he began a lot of the discoveries on this, that you find these concepts encoded in the signs of the zodiac and also in the tarot. Actually, the tarot was the first symbol system that I had found these in.
Huh.
And I was taking a course, and as the lecturer went through the arcana one by one each week, I was seeing these concepts being spelled out and in the right order, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is the displaying how how ordered patterns form out of a disorder, initial state of disorder. And this was the theory I was working on as to how could matter have come into being in the universe. And it seemed that whoever put together the tarot knew of this this science, these principles.
How far back can we trace the origins of the tarot?
Well, the tarot, it originated the cards, tarot deck cards, original Marseille deck, originated in Italy, 14th century,
uh-huh.
so 13th century.
Just in time for Columbus to take a deck along with him, right?
And it's believed the gypsies brought it there, mm-hmm. Who were coming from India through Egypt. They theorized that they picked up the concepts in Egypt. Iamblichus, who was a Neoplatonist around, 400 or 500 A.D., wrote a treatise about, it's called the Egyptian Mysteries, about initiation ceremonies that were carried on in secret chambers beneath the Sphinx.
Right.
Where the new priests who were indoctrinated into the mysteries would mm-hmm. have to learn these principles, which were encoded in frescoes on the wall of this chamber.
Now, hold on right there. Chamber under the Sphinx. Boy, Edgar Cayce talked about that. Many have. Has anyone ever actually done any thermography or tomography? Was it tomography? Anyway, I get confused. To find out if there is, in fact, a large or series of chambers under the Sphinx. I know we have the technology to do it now. I just don't know if I can recall if it has been done.
I know they were using some, sonic soundings, and
sure.
I did find some passages. I'm not really up to date on the latest, and I've heard stories, which you don't know what to believe, because you know, you hear through the Internet.
You know what I believe? I believe that there are, and I believe that Zahi Hawass and a lot of other people know about it, and I think they've been down there and have been walking all over the place and probably looted or left in place many treasures that would just boggle the minds of hundreds of millions of people around the world. I do believe they've gone in there. They've probably tunneled into it from locations that are adjacent or further away. They're not about to sit and not explore these things. Mm. And I think we both know, Paul, and many people listening, that this is the big the big enchilada to find out what's under there, and they're not going to sit around.
I would be more than happy to assist them if they found something.
Damn right.
I think a lot of these people don't have any background in systems concepts, and so probably if these tarot frescoes were discovered down there, they probably wouldn't understand the meaning. It's sort of like we're on the outside. We're not in the inside group.
Right.
And so everyone depends on them knowing what to do.
They're not even going to tell us they've been down there, though, for goodness sakes.
It's the same in the black projects. You know, there's certain arrogance that the people in these secret projects know it all. But maybe there's people out here that could help them, you know. But we can't because we don't have clearance, you know.
Right.
So this is the price you pay for secrecy, unfortunately. But anyway, so This appears to be a science that's very ancient, that dates from probably before the Ice Age, and may actually be, I believe, from another planet.
Could be. Why not? Hold on, Paul. We have to pause. Come right back in just a couple of minutes. Paul LaViolette, PhD, Earth Under Fire, looking back in order to see what's ahead. Lots of ground to cover just ahead. Don't go away. Happened in our past, and maybe it wasn't always just us that was around in our past, but that's another story. So, Paul, what galactic spasm occurred, or was it a spasm that froze those mammoths in place with the greens in their mouths, and God only knows how many other things?
Mm-hmm.
And when did it happen? We've got it pretty well nailed down, don't we?
Well, it wasn't a brief event. It's something that lasted several thousand years.
Yeah, but when it struck like somebody threw a switch, apparently.
So as far as the mammoths go, that was a part of this, but that was caused from the sun. The initial trigger, though, came from the center of the galaxy.
A galactic wave.
A galactic superwave.
Which is, let's just define it.
It's a wave of cosmic rays, very intense volley of cosmic rays.
Do we know what kind of rays?
Mostly electrons, also some high-energy protons. These are very high-energy particles, charged particles, and they are accompanied with radiation of all wavelengths, from radio waves up to gamma rays.
Would almost wipe out most life on the planet, wouldn't it? Potentially?
Judging from the past events, the radiation hasn't been intense enough to be lethal like it would be in some other galaxies.
All right, so
we're fortunate to live in a galaxy where it doesn't reach those levels.
Do we have a geologic record at some place showing this huge pulse of energy?
Yeah, we have the ice core record. Both from Greenland and Antarctica. And if you study the concentrations of beryllium-10 in the ice, you can get a record of cosmic ray activity going into the past. We have record that goes back something like 140,000 years or more. And the beryllium-10 is produced by cosmic rays hitting the atmosphere. It's a radioactive element that doesn't normally exist on Earth. So when you look at the record, you see these peaks.
Right.
And let me shut off this phone.
That's for me. You better answer it.
Okay.
All right.
So you find peaks. In fact, one set of peaks occurs at the end of the Ice Age, which is the event that was encoded in the zodiac. The zodiac actually gives a date, points to the center of the galaxy with an arrow, and indicates a particular date for this explosion, when it arrived here.
We're assuming it was visible then at some distance? We could see it coming? Or could we see an initial flash?
Yeah, it would be a bluish-white light in the sky, a very bright star that would be so bright you could see it during the day. The Hopis talk about this, the Kwasana, the blue-white star. Galactic core explosions, we see them going off in other galaxies, and they produce a bluish-white light. Mm-hmm. And it's what's called synchrotron radiation. It's a radiation we discovered in the synchrotron accelerators here on Earth. And it's the same kind of radiation that's produced in these explosions by these cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see it, that's when it's already here, in effect. It takes you by surprise, unless there's some activity at the galactic core building up to it. In the event, let's say, this occurred suddenly, we wouldn't know it happened until it was already here.
So this is a Milky Way event from
right.
the core of this galaxy. And
right.
you say there were two waves, one to start the ice age and one to end it? Is that what I'm hearing, or did I miss something?
Multiple waves. It's ongoing. This is part of the normal process of any galaxy.
I see.
As the galaxy... Okay, it's really the birth process of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Counter to what the current theories are in astronomy, creation didn't happen at one time in the past in a Big Bang. It's going on right now, and the place it goes on the fastest is in the centers of galaxies. And if you look there, center of any galaxy, you see matter is being thrown out, matter and energy. You don't see matter falling into black holes like current theories claim.
You're not buying into that then?
And a lot of astronomers don't. As they learn more about it, they comment how the black hole theory is in trouble because they find regions that are entirely cleared out of any matter because the radiation coming from the center of the galaxy is so intense it swept the whole area clean. So if it was a black hole, how is it going to power itself? You know? So this is the process of birth that goes on. It's how matter is created in our galaxy. And periodically it gets out of control and it becomes explosive. And any spiral galaxy like our own will spend about 20% of its time with an active core. The core is very bright and throwing out cosmic rays. So we're lucky in that during the past interglacial period, so 11,000 years, we haven't seen this happening. But we did go through a period at the end of the Ice Age.
All right. Okay, very good. Stand by. We'll pause. Come right back with Paul LaViolette, Ph.D., Earth Under Fire. There's a lot to talk about here on what's causing that big galactic pulse from the center of this galaxy. Other speculative things. Paul is a man, as I said, a great astrophysical vision, not to mention astrological vision as well. So we'll be back and pursue this right after this. So we've got an enormous pulse of energy from the center of the galaxy, which caused on this planet the Ice Age, which lasted 100,000 years. Who's counting? Long time. What? How did it achieve that? We know the entire planet wasn't frozen over. We know that much. So what happened?
What happens is the cosmic ray wind that's coming from the galactic center during one of these events pushes cosmic dust into the solar system.
Right.
There, as we have been studying what's out there, we've learned more and more about the dust and cometary debris that surrounded the solar system. Back in the 1980s, when I was doing my PhD dissertation on this, the view at that time was that space was essentially empty around the solar system. So the idea of debris in our immediate vicinity was totally new. There had been some talk about clouds of cosmic dust, but that was about it.
Right.
And what I was proposing is not only does existing dust out there get pushed in, but also the cosmic rays get caught in the heliopause sheath, which is a magnetic sheath around the solar system, and they form kind of a radiation belt there and form very high radiation levels, which are able to vaporize cometary debris. So they actually vaporize the surfaces of comets just as if those comets had come close to the sun and generate a nebula. So tens of thousands of times more dust than we see today around the solar system would have been generated at that time. And it would have completely changed the way light radiation gets to Earth from the sun. The sun would have become reddened, so we would have been getting a lot of infrared radiation from the sun,
right?
Which becomes more absorbed in the atmosphere. You would have gotten inversion effects. This could have created storms, blizzards. You would have gotten light scattering from this dust, which I call the interplanetary hothouse effect. So it would actually increase the Earth's radiation budget. We would be getting more radiation than we do today, actually. And paradoxically, you need heat in order to generate ice sheets, because somehow that water has to get evaporated and then precipitated in polar regions. So this was what was happening. And at the same time, the sun was becoming activated by the presence of this dust around it.
Okay.
And there are various lengths of superwaves. Some might last only 100 years or less. Others can last from hundreds to thousands of years. And the longer a superwave lasts, the longer this dust is in the solar system as a result of that, the more the sun has a chance to get aggravated by it, and it actually becomes overly luminous. So the sun becomes different than we see it today. The photosphere actually expands. It becomes much brighter, flaring continuously.
Right.
The peak solar flare activity that we have in the sun is nothing like the low period during one of these events.
So does it feed off the galactic wave, our sun, and really start lashing out, so to speak?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. In fact, you study in the myths, there's reference to the sun being, I guess it's Horus who is stung by the scorpion.
It must have been quite, as what you're saying, it must have been an incredible show for people who were around it.
Right. The sun would have been entirely different. At some times it would have been blocked out. Visible light could have been blocked out by clouds of cosmic dust intervening. It would have been a very eerie landscape. What happened with the extinction of the mammoths, I believe, was a solar conflagration. During the height of the activity of the sun was throwing off coronal mass ejections very frequently, and these would have been super compared to what we see today, intense enough that would actually defeat the Earth's magnetic field. We see it happening today during a solar storm. When the Earth is hit with a coronal mass ejection, its magnetic field drops. And that's because the cosmic rays from the sun generate a current, like a giant generator around the Earth, called a ring current,
right,
which neutralizes the Earth's magnetic field. And the biggest such event we've seen in the last 40, 50 years produced a 1% drop of the Earth's magnetic field intensity. But during the Ice Age period, when you had the solar flare activity was perhaps 50 or 100 times what we see today, you would have had events that would have completely neutralized the field, which would mean that the ball of plasma that the sun threw out would actually contact the surface of the Earth. The Earth would have had no protection. And this would explain the stories of the burning of the Earth. And at the time of the extinction of the mastodons and mammoths and saber-toothed tigers, you do see a blackened layer at that dating to that point, to that time of history. And it's radioactive, actually. Carbon-14 is very high in that level. And this could be caused by the cosmic ray bombardment from the sun.
I see.
So it's actually the sun that presents more of a hazard to life than the superwave itself. But the superwave is ultimately responsible for triggering all these events.
Well, all right. So what is it at the center of this galaxy that is pushing out this infrequent but enormous and sometimes very lengthy stream of energy? I assume in a 360-degree radius.
Yeah, it's a what I call a mother star.
Mother star, all right.
The mass is about, in this case, about 2.6 million solar masses in size.
Okay, back in a minute with Paul, and we'll find out more about this. And for those of you who know about pulsars and the like, don't go anywhere because there's some much fascinating speculation and theorizing, and very pragmatically so, from Paul to Kant. The Violet, PhD. So let's visualize this now. We got the Milky Way galaxy. Wonder what other people call it. We call it the Milky Way. And at the center of it, and I don't know if we can look at the center of it from where we are on the planet. I guess we, on a clear night, we might get an idea.
It's in the region of Scorpio and Sagittarius.
All right. And what's up there in that region that we can't see that is throwing out these infrequent cosmic burps?
If you imagine a star that's about the size of the sun, but it the density is a million times greater. So would be a material like what a white dwarf is made out of, like where they talk about one ton, like one cubic centimeter weighs a ton, this sort of thing.
How do we know this?
We know, for example, in the case of white dwarfs, that these exist because we can measure the diameter of the star, and we know the mass from, in the case of a binary, from its orbit around the other star. In the case of the galactic center, we really can't get a fix on the diameter. That's the problem. Because it's not visible. It's radiating all this energy, and we can't see the visible light because it's shrouded in dust. There's dust lanes between us and the center. We can see it in the radio frequencies, but radio frequencies, it's very difficult to get an image like you would with a star. Even optically, something that far away, you can't really resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only imagine what its size would be. We can get some idea from outbursts based on how long they last and so on. And the smallest size we put it in as a upper limit, it has to be smaller than the Earth's orbit.
All right.
I'm suggesting that if it was made out of white dwarf-like material, it would be around the size of the Sun. If you looked at it, you wouldn't see it radiating light. It would be radiating cosmic rays. So to us, it would look dark.
Right.
Although it would be putting out enormous amounts of energy.
Okay. All right. And you probably
have elements that don't exist on Earth that would exist at the center of the star.
Paul, why does it pulse? Why does it do what it does? Do we have a guess?
Okay. You need new physics, I believe, to explain this. The theory I've developed, it's called subquantum kinetics, offers an explanation of why you have this cyclical behavior there. And that is that gravity acts as sort of a throttle on the rate of energy production in a star. So that if the gravity potential, the gravity well, let's say, of a star, were to become more negative, let's say, generated more mass inside itself,
right.
So the gravity well got deeper, its rate of energy production would go up. And this Sagittarius A star, it's called, the galactic core, is actually generating both matter and energy. So it's growing over time, and it's throwing out matter, which form as very massive stars. There's blue supergiants and what's called Wolf-Rayet stars, which are very massive stars, over 100 times the mass of the Sun, that orbit this. And with all this matter in the region, it creates a very deep gravity well as more and more matter gathers, and so the rate of energy production increases. Finally, the thing becomes supercritical, like a nuclear reactor that's gotten out of control and goes into its explosive mode. And what that does is it sweeps the region clean, and after so many hundreds or thousands of years, the process subsides again because the gravity potential has come back to a more normal level.
Hmm.
Now, this is something that's not predicted by general relativity or standard theories of physics, but I have made predictions with subquantum kinetics, and so far 10 a priori predictions, meaning that they were published before they were confirmed, that they were confirmed after they were published.
I see.
Also, the galactic superwave theory, I've had something like 13 or 14 confirmations so far of predictions that were published.
Mm-hmm.
So this leads me to believe there's something to this. It's a way of understanding what's going on there.
All right. So do we have, through ice cores, ideas of how often these... Is there any regularity to these superwaves that come through? Or is it random?
Yeah, you do see major events about every 26,000 years, and you also see some that are spaced around 13,000 year period. So think in terms of the Earth's precessional cycle, that there's a predominant mode that matches the precessional cycle and also a half precessional cycle. And you saw these events going on even during the Ice Age, but they weren't enough to terminate the Ice Age. It took a very large event, the one that happened between 16,000 and 11,000 years ago, to actually bring an end to the Ice Age. And then you see smaller events, like there was a small spike. If you look at the ice core record, you see a small spike around 5,300 years ago, which was at the, around the time of the beginning of the Mayan calendar, curiously, and also the rise of the Egyptian Empire followed that. It was the boundary between the Neolithic and the ancient and historical times. Then there's very small events which we don't see recorded in the ice record, but we do see puffs of gas out there near the galactic center, and we can track these and come with dates when they were expelled from the galactic center.
Mm-hmm.
And there were something like 14 of these small burps, or whatever you want to call them, coming from the galactic center, which could have been associated also with superwaves, very small events. The last of these happened about 700 years ago. And this could have been much more powerful than that gamma ray burst, which we experienced in December of 2004.
Was that damaging, Paul, to our planet?
Back then, 700 years ago, I don't think it would have done too much. There wouldn't have been much of a radiation hazard. It wouldn't have been able to push cosmic dust into the solar system to the extent to cause any climatic effect. But if it were the same thing happened today, it would have been disastrous because it would have knocked out the satellites. All our communication systems would be down. It could create EMP. We would have had blackouts, not in just one location, but entire countries would be down. All their electrical systems overloaded, could zap all the chips in our car. It would be similar to a high-altitude nuclear explosion.
You mean a neutron bomb or an EMP?
Yeah, without the radiation hazard. It's more of the EMP
EMP burst, okay.
Right. So that
could happen any time.
So yeah, something like that would be economically disastrous for the world.
Well, yeah, the computer age would be over, at least temporarily.
Yeah.
There would be a glitch, as they say. So if this occasional pulse of galactic super energy comes from the mother star every so often, it would seem to be able to neutralize a lot of life forms on a lot of planets as it at least nearer its point of origin than it would out here.
Right.
Is that what we're thinking about? Does it kind of spay and neuter planets as it rolls out from its center location?
Yeah, I would guess that there's very little intelligent life living close to the galactic core because it just wouldn't survive these outbursts. It's not to say that, let's say, a third of the weight let's say we're at 23,000 light years from the galactic core. Let's say you could have civilizations living 6,000 or 7,000 light years from the galactic core, and they'd probably be okay. But as you get closer, the probability goes up that it could become exterminated. Now, it's sort of like we live on the edge of a galactic volcano. And this is the most important thing for all civilizations to deal with in the galaxy, and it would be the natural subject for extraterrestrial communication, because that's what you do. You pick a subject that everyone has in common as your message,
right?
Because you can relate to that.
Okay. All right. Let's getting ready to take a break here. When we come back, we'll try and tie this into the concept that people left us a message. That's pretty intriguing. And I guess when you look at, and by the way, if you take the average newspaper and break it down into, say, 10 components, world news, national news, sports, classifieds, local news, editorials, obituaries, the number one choice of newspaper readers every day is the astrology section. Now, I don't know whether to run or scratch my head over that one. But that's the truth, because a lot of these things are written by people that, well, who knows? Who knows? Who knows what sign they're born under? Except beware. But that's the way it is. So we'll find out how much of this astrology that we know and are familiar with has to do with what Paul and his work have proposed. Earth Under Fire, and we're going to talk about pulsars and fascinating theory. I'll never forget the first time Paul explained it to me. I've never let it stray far from my mind. We'll see. Much more ahead with Paul the Biolette, Ph.D.